Chapter 8. The next night, Blaze decided he ought to get cool plates for his hot Ford, so he stole a pair off a Volkswagen in the parking lot of Jolly Jim's Giant Groceries in Portland. He replaced the plates from the VW with the Ford's plates. It could be weeks or months before the VW's owner realized he had the wrong set of plates, because the number on the little sticker was 7. Meaning the guy didn't have to re-register until July. Always check the registration sticker. George had taught him that. He drove to a discount store feeling safe with his new plates, knowing he would feel safer still when the Ford was a different color. He bought 4 cans of Skylark Blue auto paint and a spray gun. He went home broke but happy. He ate supper sitting next to the stove, thumping his feet on the worn linoleum, as Merle Haggard sang Okie from Muskogee. Old Merle had really known how to dish it up to those fucking hippies. After the dishes were washed, he ran the adhesive-patched extension cord out to the shed and hung a bulb over a beam. Blaze loved to paint, and Skylark Blue was one of his favorite colors. You had to like that name. It meant blue like a bird, like a skylark. He went back to the house and got a pile of old newspapers. George read a newspaper every day, and not just the funnies. Sometimes he read the editorials to Blaze and raged about the redneck Republicans. He said the Republicans hated poor people. He referred to the president as that goddamn wet in the White House. George was a Democrat, and 2 years ago they had put stickers for Democratic candidates on 3 different stolen cars. All the newspapers were way old, and ordinarily that would have made Blaze feel sad. But tonight he was too excited about painting the car. He papered the windows and wheels. He scotch-taped more pieces to the chrome trim. By 9 o'clock, the fragrant banana smell of spray paint filled the shed, and by 11, the job was done. Blaze took off the newspapers and touched up a few places, then admired his work. He thought it was good work. He went to bed a little high from the paint and woke up the next morning with a headache. "George?" he said hopefully. No answer. "I'm broke, George. I'm busted to my heels." No answer. Blaze moped around the house all day, wondering what to do. The Nightman was reading a paperback epic called Butch Ballerinas, when a Colt revolver was shoved in his face. Same Colt, same voice saying gruffly, "Everything in the register." "Oh, no," Harry Nason said. "Oh, Christ." He looked up. Standing before him was a flat-nosed Chinese horror in a woman's nylon stocking that trailed down his back like the tail of a ski cap.
"Not you, not again.
Everything in the register. Put it in a bag." No one came in this time, and because it was a weeknight, there was less in the drawer. The stick-up man paused on the way out and turned back.
"Now," Harry Nason thought, "I will be shot."
But instead of shooting him, the stick-up man said,
"This time I remembered the stocking."
Behind the nylon, he appeared to be grinning. Then he was gone. Chapter 9. When Clayton Blaisdell Jr. came to Hetton House, there was a headmistress. He didn't remember her name, only her gray hair and her big gray eyes behind her spectacles, and that she read them the Bible and ended every morning assembly by saying, "Be good, children, and you shall prosper." Then one day she wasn't in the office anymore, because she had a stroke. At first Blaze thought people were saying she had a stork, but finally he got it straight. Stroke. It was a kind of headache that wouldn't go away. Her replacement was Martin Coslaw. Blaze never forgot his name, and not just because the kids called him the Law. Blaze never forgot him because the Law taught arithmetic. Arithmetic was held in room 7 on the 3rd floor,
where it was cold enough to freeze the balls off a brass monkey in the winter. There were pictures of George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and Sister Mary Hetton on the walls. Sister Hetton had pale skin and black hair, scooped back from her face, and bald into a kind of doorknob on the back of her head. She had dark eyes that sometimes came back to accuse Blaze of things after lights out, mostly of being dumb. Probably too dumb for high school, just as the law said. Room 7 had old yellow floors and always smelled of floor varnish, a smell that made Blaze sleepy even if he was wide awake when he walked in. There were 9 fly-specked light globes that sent down thin, sad light on rainy days. There was an old blackboard at the front of the room, and over it were green placards upon which the alphabet marched in rolling Palma Method letters, both the capital letters and the little fellows. After the alphabet came the numbers from 0 to 9, so beautiful and nice they made you feel stupid and clumsier than ever just looking at them. The desks were carved with overlapping slogans and initials, most worn to ghosts by repeated sandings and revarnishings, but never erased completely. They were bolted to the floor on iron disks. Each desk had an inkwell. The inkwells were filled with Carter's ink. Spilled ink got you a stropping in the washroom. Black heel marks on the yellow floor got you a stropping. Fooling in class got you a stropping. Only class fooling was called bad deportment. There were other stropping offenses. Martin Koslaw believed in stropping and the paddle. The law's paddle was more feared in Hetton House than anything, even the boogeyman that hid under the beds of the little kids. The paddle was a birch spatula, quite thin. The law had drilled 4 holes in it to lessen air resistance. He was a bowler with a team called the Falmouth Rockers, and on Fridays he sometimes wore his bowling shirt to school. It was dark blue and had his name, Martin, in cursive gold over the breast pocket. To Blaze, those letters looked almost, but not quite, like Palmer Method. The law said that in bowling and in life, if a person made the spares, the strikes would take care of themselves. He had a strong right arm from making all those strikes and spares, and when he gave someone a stropping with the paddle, it hurt a lot. He had been known to bite his tongue between his teeth while applying the paddle to a boy with especially bad deportment. Sometimes he bit it hard enough to make it bleed, and for a while there was a boy at Hetton House who called him Dracula as well as the law. But then that boy made out, and they didn't see him anymore. Making out was what they called it when someone got placed with a family and stuck, maybe even adopted. Martin Koslaw was hated and feared by all the boys at Hetton House, but no one hated him and feared him more than Blaze. Blaze was very bad at arithmetic. He had been able to get back the hang of adding 2 apples plus 3 apples, but only with great effort, and a quarter of an apple plus a half an apple was always going to be beyond him. So far as he knew, apples only came in bites. It was during basic arithmetic that Blaze pulled his first con, aided by his friend, John Cheltzman. John was skinny, ugly, gangling, and filled with hate. The hate rarely showed. Mostly it was hidden behind his thick, adhesive-taped glasses and the idiotic, farmerish yuck-yuck-yuck that was his frequent laughter. He was a natural target of the older, stronger boys. They beat him around pretty good. His face was rubbed in the dirt, spring and fall, or washed in snow, winter. His shirts were often torn. He rarely emerged from the communal shower without getting ass-smacked by a few wet towels. He always wiped the dirt or snow off, tucked his ripped shirt tail in, or went yuck, yuck, yuck as he rubbed his reddening ass cheeks, and the hate hardly ever showed. Or his brains. He was good in his classes, quite good. He couldn't help that. but anything above a B was rare and not welcomed. At Hetton House, A stood for asshole, not to mention ass-kicking. Blaze was starting to get his size by then. He didn't have it, not at 11 or 12, but he was starting to get it. He was as big as some of the big boys, and he didn't join in the playground beatings or the towel snappings. One day, John Chelsman walked up to him while Blaze was standing beside the fence at the far end of the playground, not doing anything but watching crows light in the trees and take off again. He offered Blaze a deal. "You have the law again for math this half," John said. "Fractions continue."
"I hate fractions," Blaze said.
"I'll do your homework if you don't let those lugs tune up on me anymore. It won't be good enough to make him suspicious, not good enough to get you caught, but it'll be good enough to get you by. You won't get stood after."
Being stood after wasn't as bad as being stropped, but it was bad. You had to stand in the corner of room 7, face to the wall. You couldn't look at the clock. Blaze considered John Chelsman's idea, then shook his head.
"He'll know. I'll get called on to recite, and then he'll know."
"You just look around the room like you're thinking," John said. "I'll take care of you."
And John did. He wrote down the homework answers, and Blaze copied them in his own numbers that tried to look like the Palmer Method numbers over the blackboard but never did. Sometimes the law called on him, and then Blaze would stand up and look around, anywhere but at Martin Koslaw, and that was all right. That was how just about everyone behaved when they were called on. During his looking around, he'd look at Johnny Chelsman, slumped in his seat by the door to the book closet with his hands on his desk. If the number the law wanted was 10 or under, the number of fingers showing would be the answer. If it was a fraction, John's hands would be in fists. Then they'd open. He was very quick about it. The left hand was the top half of the fraction. The right hand was the bottom. If the bottom number was over 5, Johnny went back to fists and then used both hands. Blaze had no trouble at all with these signals, which many would have found more complex than the fractions they represented.
"Well, Clayton," the law would say, "we're waiting."
And Blaze would say,
"1/6?
He didn't always have to be right. When he told George, George had nodded in approval.
"A beautiful little con. When did it break down?"
It broke down 3 weeks into the half, and when Blaze thought about it, he could think. It just took time, and it was hard work. He realized that the law must have been suspicious about Blaze's amazing mathematical turnaround all along. He just hadn't let on. Had been paying out the rope Blaze needed to hang himself with. There was a surprise quiz. Blaze flunked with a grade of 0. This was because the quiz was all fractions. The quiz had really been given for one purpose and one purpose only, and that was to catch Clayton Blaisdell, Jr. Below the 0 was a note scrawled in bright red letters. Blaze couldn't make it out, so he took it to John. John read it. At first he didn't say anything. Then he told Blaze, "This note says John Chelsman is going to resume getting beat up."
"What?
Huh?" "It says, report to my office at 4 o'clock.
"What for?"
"Because we forgot about the tests," John said. Then he said, "No, you didn't forget. I forgot. Because all I could think about was getting those overgrown Blutos to stop hurting me. Now you're going to beat me up, and then the law is going to strop me, and then the Blutos are going to start in on me again. Jesus Christ, I wish I was dead."
And he did look like he wished it.
"I'm not going to beat you up."
"No?"
John looked at him with the eyes of one who wants to believe but can't quite.
"You couldn't take the test for me. Could you?"
Martin Koslaw's office was a fairly large room with headmaster on the door. There was a small blackboard in it, across from the window.
The window looked out on Hetton House's miserable schoolyard. The blackboard was dusted with chalk, and Blaze's downfall, fractions. Koslaw was sitting behind his desk when Blaze came in. He was frowning at nothing. Blaze gave him something else to frown at.
"Knock," he said.
"Huh?"
"Go back and knock," said the law.
"Oh."
Blaze turned, went out, knocked, and came back in. "Thank you."
"Sure." Koslaw frowned at Blaze. He picked up a pencil and began to tap it on his desk. It was a red grading pencil.
"Clayton Blaisdell, Jr.," he said.
He brooded.
"Such a long name for such a short intellect."
"The other kids call me—"
"I don't care what the other kids call you. A kid is a baby goat. A kid is a piece of slang passed around by idiots. I don't care for it, or those who use it. I am an instructor of arithmetic. My task is to prepare young fellows such as yourself for high school, if they can be prepared, and also to teach them the difference between right and wrong. If my responsibilities ceased with the instruction of arithmetic, and sometimes I wish they did, often I wish they did, that would not be the case. But I am also headmaster, hence the instruction of right versus wrong. Quod erat demonstrandum. Do you know what quod erat demonstrandum means, Mr. Blaisdell?"
"Nope," Blaze said. His heart was sinking, and he could feel water rising in his eyes. He was big for his age, but now he felt small. Small and getting smaller. Knowing that was how the law wanted him to feel didn't change it.
"No, and never will. Because even if you ever attain your sophomore year in high school, which I doubt, you will never get closer to geometry than the drinking fountain at the end of the hall."
The law steepled his fingers and rocked back in his chair. His bowling shirt was hung over the back of his chair, and it rocked with him.
"It means that which was to be demonstrated, Mr. Blaisdell. And what I demonstrated by my little quiz is that you are a cheater. A cheater is a person who does not know the difference between right and wrong. QED. Quod erat demonstrandum. And thus, punishment."
Blaze cast his eyes down at the floor. He heard a drawer pulled open. Something was removed, and the drawer was slid closed. He did not have to look up to know what the law was now holding in his hand.
"I abhor a cheater," Koslaw said. "But I understand your mental shortcomings, Mr. Blaisdell, and thus I understand there is one worse than you in this little plot. That would be the one who first put the idea into your obviously thick head and then abetted you. Are you following me?"
"No," Blaze said. Koslaw's tongue crept out a bit, and his teeth engaged it firmly. He gripped the paddle with equal or greater firmness.
"Who did your assignments?"
Blaze said nothing. "You didn't tattle. All the comic books, TV shows, and movies said the same thing. You didn't tattle, especially not on your only friend. And there was something else, something that struggled for expression."
"You hadn't ought to strop me," he said finally. "Oh?"
Koslaw looked amazed.
"Do you say so? And why is that, Mr. Blaisdell? Elucidate. I am fascinated."
Blaze didn't know those big words, but he knew that look. He had been seeing it his whole life.
"You don't care nothing about teaching me. You just want to make me feel small and hurt whoever stopped you doing it for a little while. That's wrong. You hadn't ought to strop me when you're the one who's wrong."
The law no longer looked amazed. Now he only looked mad, so mad a vein was pulsing right in the middle of his forehead.
"Who did your assignments?"
Blaze said nothing.
"How could you answer in class? How did that part work?"
Blaze said nothing.
"Was it Cheltzman? I think it was Cheltzman."
Blaze said nothing. His fists were clenched, trembling. Tears spilled out of his eyes, but he didn't think they were feeling small tears now. Koslaw swung the paddle and struck Blaze high up on one arm. It made a crack like a small gun. It was the first time Blaze had ever been struck by a teacher anywhere except on the ass, although sometimes, when he was littler, his ear had been twisted, and once or twice his nose.
"Answer me, you brainless moose!"
"Fuck you!" Blaze cried, the nameless thing finally leaping all the way free.
"Fuck you! Fuck you!"
"Come here," the law said. His eyes were huge, bugging out. The hand holding the paddle had gone white.
"Come here, you bag of God's trash!"
And with the nameless thing that was rage now out of him, and because he was, after all, a child, Blaze went. When he walked out of the law's study 20 minutes later, his breath whistling raggedly in his throat and his nose bleeding, but still dry-eyed and close-mouthed, he became a Hetton House legend. He was done with arithmetic. During October and most of November, instead of going to room 7, he went to room 19, study hall. That was fine by Blaze. It was 2 weeks before he could lie on his back comfortably, and then that was fine, too. One day in late November, he was once more summoned to Headmaster Koslaw's office. Sitting there in front of the blackboard were a man and a woman of middle age. To Blaze, they looked dry, like they might have been blown in on the late autumn wind like leaves. The law was seated behind his desk. His bowling shirt was nowhere to be seen. The room was cold because the window had been opened to let in the bright, thin November sun. Besides being a bowling nut, the law was a fresh air fiend. The visiting couple did not seem to mind. The dry man was wearing a gray suit jacket with padded shoulders and a string tie. The woman was wearing a plaid coat and a white blouse under it. Both had blocky, vein-ridged hands. His were calloused. Hers were cracked and red.
"Mr. and Mrs. Bowie, this is the boy of whom I spoke. Take off your hat, young Blaisdell."
Blaze took off his Red Sox cap. Mr. Bowie looked at him critically.
"He's a big un. Only 11, you say? 12 next month. He'll be a good help around your place."
"He ain't got nothing, does he?"
Mrs. Bowie asked. Her voice was high and reedy. It sounded strange coming from that mammoth breast, which rose under her plaid coat like a comber at Higgins Beach.
"No TB, no nothing."
"He's been tested," said Koslaw. "All our boys are tested regularly, state requirement."
"Can he chop wood? That's what I need to know," Mr. Bowie said.
His face was thin and haggard, the face of an unsuccessful TV preacher.
"I'm sure he can," said Koslaw. "I'm sure he's capable of hard work. Hard physical work, I mean. He is poor at arithmetic."
Mrs. Bowie smiled. It was all lip and no teeth.
"I do the ciphering."
She turned to her husband.
"Hubert?"
Bowie considered, then nodded.
"Eh?" "Step out, please, young Blaisdell," the law said. "I'll speak to you later."
And so, without a word spoken by him, Blaze became a ward of the Bowies.
"I don't want you to go," John said. He was sitting on the cot next to Blaze's, watching as Blaze loaded his zipper bag with his few personal possessions. Most, like the zipper bag itself, had been provided by Hetton House.
"I'm sorry," Blaze said, but he wasn't, or not entirely. He only wished Johnny could come along.
"They'll start pounding on me as soon as you're down the road. Everybody will."
John's eyes moved rapidly back and forth in their sockets, and he picked at a fresh pimple on the side of his nose.
"No, they won't."
"They will, and you know it." Blaze did know it. He also knew there was nothing he could do about it.
"I gotta go. I'm a miner."
He smiled at John.
"Miner, 49er. Dreadful sorry, Clementine."
For Blaze, this was nearly juvenilian wit,
but John didn't even smile. He reached out and grasped Blaze's arm hard, as if to store its texture in his memory forever. "You won't ever come back." But Blaze did. The Bowies came for him in an old Ford pickup that had been painted a grotesque and lap-marked white some years before. There was room for three in the cab, but Blaze rode in back. He didn't mind. The sight of H.H. shrinking in the distance, then disappearing, filled him with joy. They lived in a huge, ramshackle farmhouse in Cumberland, which borders Falmouth on one side and Yarmouth on the other. The house was on an unpaved road and bore 1,000 coats of road dust. It was unpainted. In front was a sign reading, "Bowie's Collies." To the left of the house was a huge dog pen, in which 28 collies ran and barked and yapped constantly. Some had the mange. The hair fell out of them in big patches, revealing the tender pink hide beneath for the season's few remaining bugs to eat. To the right of the house was weedy pasture land. Behind it was a gigantic old barn where the Bowies kept cows. The house stood on 40 acres. Most was given over to hay, but there was also 7 acres of mixed soft and hardwoods. When they arrived, Blaze jumped down from the truck with his zipper bag in his hand. Bowie took it.
"I'll put that away for you. You want to get chopping."
Blaze blinked at him. Bowie pointed to the barn. A series of sheds connected it to the house, zigzagging, forming something that was almost a dooryard. A pile of logs stood against one shed wall. Some were maple, some were pine, with the sap coagulating in blisters on the bark. In front of the pile stood an old, scarred chopping block with an axe buried in it.
"You want to get chopping," Hubert Bowie said again.
"Oh," Blaze said. It was the first word he had said to either of them. The Bowies watched him go over to the chopping block and free the axe. He looked at it, then stood it in the dust beside the block. Dogs ran and yapped ceaselessly. The smallest collies were the shrillest.
"Well?" Bowie asked.
"Sir, I ain't never chopped wood."
Bowie dropped the zipper bag in the dust. He walked over and sat a maple chunk on the chopping block. He spat in one palm, clapped his hands together, and brought up the axe. Blaze watched closely. Bowie brought the blade down. The chunk fell in two pieces.
"There," he said. "Now they're stove lengths." He held out the axe. "You."
Blaze rested it between his legs, then spat in one palm and clapped his hands together. He went to pick up the axe, then remembered he hadn't put no chunk of wood on the block. He put one on, raised the axe, and brought it down. His piece fell in a pair of stove lengths almost identical to Bowie's. Blaze was delighted. The next moment he was sprawling in the dirt, his right ear ringing from the backhand blow Bowie had fetched him with one of his dry, work-hardened hands.
"What was that for?"
Blaze asked, looking up.
"Not knowing how to chop wood," Bowie said. "And before you say it ain't your fault, boy, it ain't mine neither. Now you want to get chopping."
His room was a tiny afterthought on the third floor of the rambling farmhouse. There was a bed and a bureau, nothing else. There was one window. Everything you saw through it looked wavy and distorted. It was cold in the room at night, colder in the morning. Blaze didn't mind the cold, but he minded the Bowies. Them he minded more and more. Minding became dislike, and dislike finally became hate. The hate grew slowly. For him it was the only way. It grew at its own pace, and it grew completely, and it put forth red flowers. It was the sort of hate no intelligent person ever knows. It was its own thing. It was not adulterated by reflection. He chopped a great deal of wood that fall and winter. Bowie tried to teach him how to hand milk, but Blaze couldn't do it. He had what Bowie called hard hands. The cows grew skittish no matter how gently he tried to wrap his fingers around their teats. Then their nervousness came back to him, closing the circuit. The flow of milk slowed to a trickle, then stopped. Bowie never boxed his ears or slapped the back of his head for this. He would not have milking machines. He did not believe in milking machines. He said those DeLavels used cows up in their prime, but would allow that hand-milking was a talent, and because it was, you could no more punish someone for not having it than you could punish someone for not being able to write what he called poetry.
"You can chop wood, though," he said, not smiling. "You got the talent for that."
Blaze chopped it and carried it, filling the kitchen woodbox 4 and 5 times a day. There was an oil furnace, but Hubert Bowie refused to run it until February, because the price of number 2 was so dear. Blaze also shoveled out the 90-foot driveway once the snow got going, forked hay, cleaned the barn, and scrubbed Mrs. Bowie's floors. On weekdays he was up at 5 to feed the cows, 4 on mornings when snow had fallen, and to get breakfast before the yellow SAD-106 bus came to take him to school. The Bowies might have done away with school if they had been able, but they were not. At Hetton House, Blaze had heard both good stories and bad stories about school out, mostly bad ones from the big boys who went to Freeport High. Blaze was still too young for that, however. He went to Cumberland District A during his time with the Bowies, and he liked it. He liked his teacher. He liked to memorize poems, to stand up in class and recite, "By the rude bridge that arched the flood." He declaimed these poems in his red and black checked hunting jacket, which he never took off because he forgot it during fire drills, his green flannel pants, and his green gum-rubber boots. He stood 5'11", dwarfing every other sixth grader in his class, and his height was overtopped by his grinning face and dented forehead. No one ever laughed at Blaze when he recited poems. He had a great many friends, even though he was a state kid, because he wasn't contentious or bullying, nor was he sullen. In the schoolyard, he was everyone's bear. He sometimes rode as many as 3 first graders on his shoulders at once. He never took advantage of his size at keep away. He would be tackled by 5, 6, 7 players at once, swaying, swaying, usually grinning, his dented face turned up to the sky, finally toppling like a building, to the inevitable cheers of all. Mrs. Wasluski, who was a Catholic, saw him toting first graders around on his shoulders one day when she had playground duty, and started calling him St. Francis of the Little People. Mrs. Cheney brought him along in reading, writing, and history. She understood early on that for Blaze, math, which he always called arithmetic, was a lost cause. The one time she tried him on flashcards, he turned pale, and she was convinced the boy actually came close to fainting. He was slow, but not retarded. By December, he had moved from the first grade adventures of Dick and Jane to the stories in Roads to Everywhere, the third grade reader. She gave him a pile of classics comic books she kept bound in hardcovers to take back to the Bowies, with a note saying they were homework. His favorite, of course, was Oliver Twist, which he read over and over until he knew every word. All this continued until January, and might have continued until spring, except for 2 unfortunate events. He killed a dog, and he fell in love. He hated the collies, but one of his chores was to feed them. They were purebreds, but poor diets and lives lived exclusively in the kennel and the pen made them ugly and neurotic. Most were cowardly and shied from the touch. They would lunge at you, yapping and snarling, only to sheer away and approach from a different angle. Sometimes they snuck in from behind, then they might nip at your calves or buttocks before dashing off. The clamor at feeding time was hellish. They were out of Hubert Bowie's province. Mrs. Bowie was also the only one they would come to. She fawned over them in her buzzing voice. She always wore a red jacket when she was with the dogs, and it was covered with tawny hair. The Bowies sold very few grown animals, but the pups fetched $200 each in the spring. Mrs. Bowie exhorted Blaze on the importance of feeding the dogs well, of feeding them what she called a good mix. Yet she never fed them, and what Blaze put in their troughs was discount chow from a feed store in Falmouth. This feed was called Dogsworth. Hubert Bowie sometimes called it cheap chow, and sometimes dog farts, but never when his wife was around. The dogs knew Blaze didn't like them, but he was afraid of them, and every day they grew more aggressive toward him. By the time the weather really began to turn cold, their dashes sometimes brought them close enough to nip him from the front. At night, he sometimes woke from dreams in which they packed together, brought him down, and began to eat him alive. He would lie in his bed after these dreams, puffing cold vapor into the dark air, and feeling himself over to make sure he was still whole. He knew he was. He knew the difference between what was dreams and what was real, but in the dark, that difference seemed thinner. Several times their bumping and dashing caused him to spill the food. Then he had to scrape it up as best he could from the packed, urine-spotted snow while they snarled and fought over it around him. Gradually, one became the leader in their undeclared war against him. His name was Randy. He was 11. He had one milky eye. He scared the shit out of Blaze. His teeth were like old yellow tusks. There was a white stripe down the center of his skull. He would approach Blaze from dead on, from 12 o'clock high, haunches pumping under his ragged pelt. Randy's good eye seemed to burn while the bad one remained indifferent to it all, a dead lamp. His claws dug small clods of yellow-white impacted snow from the floor of the dog pen. He would accelerate until it seemed impossible he could do anything but launch himself into a flight at Blaze's throat. The other dogs would be whipped into a frenzy by this, leaping and turning and snarling in the air. At the last instant, Randy's paws would come down stiff, spraying snow all over Blaze's green pants, and he would race away in a big loop, only to repeat the maneuver. But he was shearing off later and later, until he was close enough for Blaze to smell his heat and even his breath. Then, one evening toward the end of January, he knew the dog wasn't going to shear off. He didn't know how this charge was different or why, but it was. This time Randy meant it. He was going to leap, and when he did, the other dogs would come in quickly. Then it would be like in his dreams. The dog came, speeding faster and faster, silent. This time there were no paws out, no skidding or turning. Its haunches tensed, then pushed down. A moment later, Randy was in the air. Blaze was carrying two steel buckets filled with Dogsworth. When he saw Randy meant it this time, all his fear left him. He dropped his buckets at the same time Randy leaped. He was wearing rawhide gloves with holes in the fingers. He met the dog in midair with his right fist, under the long shovel shelf of the jaw. The jolt ran all the way up to his shoulder. His hand went instantly and completely numb. There was a brief bitter crack. Randy did a perfect 180 in the cold air and landed on his back with a thud. Blaze realized all the other dogs had fallen silent only when they began to bark again. He picked up the buckets, went to the trough, and poured in the chow. Always before, the dogs had crowded in at once to begin snarking it up, growling and snapping for the best places before he could even add water. He could do nothing about it. He was ineffectual. Now, when one of the smaller collies rushed for the trough with its stupid eyes gleaming and its stupid tongue hanging from the side of its stupid mouth, Blaze jerked at it with his gloved hands, and it cut sideways so fast its feet went out from under it, and it landed on its side. The others shrank back. Blaze added two buckets of water from the bib faucet. "There," he said. "It's wet down. Go on and eat it." He walked back to look at Randy while the other dogs ran to the feeding trough. The fleas were already leaving Randy's cooling body to die in the piss-stained snow. The good eye was now almost as glazed-looking as the bad one. This awoke a feeling of pity and sadness in Blaze. Perhaps the dog had only been playing after all, just trying to scare him. And he was scared. That, too. He would catch Dickens for this. He walked to the house with the empty buckets, head lowered. Mrs. Bowie was in the kitchen. She had a rubbing board propped in the sink and was washing curtains on it. She was singing a hymn in her reedy voice as she worked.
"Ah, don't you track in on my floor now," she cried, seeing him.
It was her floor, but he washed it, on his knees. Sullenness awoke in his breast. "Randy's dead. He jumped me. I hit him. Killed him." Her hands flew out of the soapy water and she screamed.
"Randy? Randy? Randy!"
She ran around in a circle, grabbed her sweater from the peg near the wood stove, then ran for the door.
"Hubert!" she called to her husband. "Hubert! Oh, Hubert! Such a bad boy!"
And then, as if still singing,
"Ooh!"
she thrust Blaze out of her way and ran outside. Mr. Bowie appeared in one of the many shed doors, his scrawny face long with surprise. He strode to Blaze and grabbed him by one shoulder.
"What happened?"
"Randy's dead," Blaze said stolidly. "He jumped me, and I did him down."
"You wait," Hubert Bowie said, and went after his wife.
Blaze took off his red and black jacket and sat down on the stool in the corner. Snow melted off his boots and made a puddle. He didn't care. The heat from the wood stove made his face throb. He chopped the wood. He didn't care. Bowie had to lead his wife back inside because she had her apron over her face. She was sobbing loudly. The high pitch of her voice made her sound like a sewing machine.
"Go out into the shed," Bowie told him.
Blaze opened the door. Bowie helped him through it with the toe of his boot. Blaze fell down the two steps into the dooryard, got up, and went into the shed. There were tools in there, axes, hammers, a lathe, an emery wheel, a planer, a sander, other things he didn't know the names of. There were auto parts and boxes of old magazines, and a snow shovel with a wide aluminum scoop, his shovel. Blaze looked at it, and something about the shovel brought his hate of the Bowies to completion, finished it off. They received $160 a month for keeping him, and he did their chores. He ate badly. He had eaten better at HH. It wasn't fair. Hubert Bowie opened the door to the shed and stepped in.
"I'm going to whip you now," he said.
"That dog jumped me. He was going for my throat."
"Don't say no more. You're only making it worse for yourself."
Every spring, Bowie bred one of his cows with Franklin Marsteller's bull Freddy. On the wall of the shed was a walking halter he called a love halter and a nosepiece. Bowie took it from its peg and held it by the nosepiece, fingers curled through the lattices, the heavy leather straps held down. "Bend over that workbench."
"Randy went for my throat. I'm telling you, it was him or me."
"Bend over that workbench."
Blaze hesitated, but he did not think. Thinking was a long process for him. Instead, he consulted the tickings of instinct. It wasn't time yet. He bent over the workbench. It was a long, hard whipping, but he didn't cry. He did that later, in his room. The girl he'd fallen in love with was a seventh grader at Cumberland A School named Marjorie Thurlow. She had yellow hair and blue eyes and no breasts. She had a sweet smile that made the corners of her eyes turn up. On the playground, Blaze followed her with his own eyes. She made him feel empty in the pit of his stomach, but in a way that was good. He imagined himself carrying her books and protecting her from outlaws. These thoughts always made his face burn. One day, not long after the incident of Randy and the whipping, the district nurse came to school to give immunization boosters. The children had been given release forms the week before. Those parents who wanted their children to have the shots had signed them. Now the children with signed forms queued up in a nervous line leading into the cloakroom. Blaze was one of these. Bowie had called up George Henderson, who was on the school board, and asked if the shots cost money. They didn't, so Bowie signed. Margie Thurlow was also in line. She looked very pale. Blaze felt bad for her. He wished he could go back and hold her hand. The thought made his face burn. He bent his head and shuffled his feet. Blaze was first in line. When the nurse beckoned him into the cloakroom, he took off his red and black checked jacket and unbuttoned the sleeve of his shirt. The nurse took the needle out of a kind of cooker, looked at his slip, then said, "Better unbutton the other sleeve too, big boy. You're down for both." "Will it hurt?" Blaze said, unbuttoning the other sleeve. "Only for a second." "Okay," Blaze said, and let her shoot the needle from the cooker into his left arm. "Right. Now the other arm and you're done." Blaze turned the other way. She shot some more stuff from another needle into his right arm. Then he left the cloakroom, went back to his desk, and began to puzzle out a story in his Scholastic. When Margie came out, there were tears in her eyes and more on her face, but she wasn't sobbing. Blaze felt proud of her. When she passed his desk on her way to the door, seventh graders were in another room, he gave her a smile, and she smiled back. Blaze folded that smile, put it away, and kept it for years. At recess, just as Blaze was coming out the door to the playground, Margie ran inside past him, sobbing. He turned to look after her, then walked slowly into the playground, brow creased, face unhappy. He came to Peter Lavoie, batting the tetherball on its post with one mittened hand, and asked if Peter knew what had happened to Margie. "Glenn hit her in the shot," Peter Lavoie said. He demonstrated on a passing boy, balling his fist and hitting the kid three times fast, whap, whap, whap. Blaze watched this, frowning. The nurse had lied. Both of his arms now hurt badly from the shots. The large muscles felt stiff and bruised. It was hard to even bend them without wincing. And Margie was a girl. He looked around for Glenn. Glenn Hardy was a huge eighth grader, the kind that will play football, then run to fat. He had red hair that he combed back from his forehead in big waves. His father was a farmer on the west end of town, and Glenn's arms were slabs of muscle. Somebody threw Blaze the keep-away ball. He dropped it on the ground without looking at it, and started for Glenn Hardy.
"Oh, boy," Peter Lavoie said. "Blaze is going after Glenn!"
The news traveled quickly. Groups of boys began to move with studied casualness toward where Glenn and some of the older boys were playing a clumsy, troll-like version of kickball. Glenn was pitching. He rolled the ball quick and hard, making it bounce and skitter on the frozen ground. Mrs. Foster, who had playground duty that day, was on the other side of the building, monitoring the little ones on the swings. She would not be a factor, at least not at first. Glenn looked up and saw Blaze coming. He dropped the kickball. He put his hands on his hips. Both teams collapsed to form a semicircle around him and behind him. They were all seventh and eighth graders. None were as big as Blaze. Only Glenn was bigger. The fourth, fifth, and sixth graders were grouped loosely behind Blaze. They shuffled, adjusted their belts, pulled self-consciously at their mittens, and mumbled to each other. The boys on both sides wore expressions of absurd casualness. The fight had not been called yet.
"What do you want, fucknuts?" Glenn Hardy asked.
His voice was phlegmy. It was the voice of a young god with a winter cold.
"Why did you hit Margie Thurlow in the shot?" Blaze asked.
"I felt like it."
"Okay," Blaze said, and waded in.
Glenn hit him twice in the face. Whap, whap. Before he even got close, and blood began to pour out of Blaze's nose. Then Glenn backed away, wanting to keep the advantage of his reach. People were yelling. Blaze shook his head. Drops of blood flew, splattering the snow on either side and in front of him. Glenn was grinning. "State kid," he said. "State kid, shit for brain, state kid." He hit Blaze in the middle of Blaze's dented forehead, and his grin faltered as pain exploded up his arm. Blaze's forehead was very hard, dented or not. For a moment he forgot to back up, and Blaze shot his fist out. He didn't use his body. He just used his arm like a piston. His knuckles connected with Glenn's mouth. Glenn screamed as his lips burst against his teeth and began to bleed. The yelling intensified. Glenn tasted his own blood and forgot about backing up. He forgot about taunting the ugly kid with the busted forehead. He just waded in, swinging roundhouse punches from port and starboard. Blaze set his feet and met him. Faintly, from far away, he heard the shouts and exhortations of his classmates. They reminded him of the yapping collies in the dog pen on the day he realized that Randy wasn't going to shear off. Glenn got in at least 3 good blows, and Blaze's head rocked with them. He gasped, inhaling blood. He heard ringing in his ear. His own fist shot out again, and he felt the jolt all the way up to his shoulder. All at once the blood on Glenn's mouth was spread on his chin and cheeks, too. Glenn spat out a tooth. Blaze struck again in the same place. Glenn howled. He sounded like a little kid with his fingers caught in a door. He stopped swinging. His mouth was a ruin. Mrs. Foster was running toward them. Her skirt was flying. Her knees were pumping, and she was blowing her little silver whistle. Blaze's arm hurt real bad where the nurse had shot him, and his fist hurt, and his head hurt, but he struck out again, desperately hard, with a hand that felt numb and dead. It was the same hand he had used on Randy, and he struck as hard as he had that day in the pen. The blow caught Glenn flush on the point of the chin. It made an audible snap sound that silenced the other children. Glenn stood slackly, his eyes rolled up to whites. Then his knees unhinged, and he collapsed in a heap. "I killed him," Blaze thought. "Oh, jeez, I killed him like Randy." But then Glenn began to stir around and mutter in the back of his throat, like people do in their sleep. And Mrs. Foster was screaming at Blaze to go inside. As he went, Blaze heard her telling Peter Lavoie to go to the office and get the first aid kit, to run. He was sent from school, suspended. They stopped the bleeding of his nose with an ice pack, put a Band-Aid on his ear, and then sent him to walk the 4 miles back to the dog farm. He got a little way down the road, then remembered his bag lunch. Mrs. Bowie always sent him with a slice of peanut butter bread folded over and an apple. It wasn't much, but it would be a long walk, and as John Chelsman said, something beat nothing every day of the week. They wouldn't let him in when he came back, but Margie Thurlow brought it out to him. Her eyes were still red from crying. She looked like she wanted to say something but didn't know how. Blaze knew how that felt and smiled at her to show it was all right. She smiled back. One of his eyes was swelled almost shut, so he looked at her with the other one. When he got to the edge of the schoolyard, he looked back to see her some more, but she was gone.
"Go out to shed," Bowie said.
"No." Bowie's eyes widened. He shook his head a little as if to clear it.
"What did you say?"
"You shouldn't want to whip me."
"I'll be the judge of that. Get out in that shed."
"No." Bowie advanced on him. Blaze backed up 2 feet and then balled up his swollen fist. He set his feet. Bowie stopped. He had seen Randy. Randy's neck had been broken like a cedar branch after a hard freeze.
"Go up to your room, you stupid son of a bitch," he said.
Blaze went. He sat on the side of his bed. From there he could hear Bowie hollering into the telephone. He figured he knew who Bowie was hollering at. He didn't care. He didn't care. But when he thought of Margie Thurlow, he cared. When he thought of Margie, he wanted to cry. the way he sometimes wanted to cry when he saw one bird sitting all by itself on a telephone wire. He didn't. He read Oliver Twist instead. He knew it by heart. He could even say the words he didn't know. Outside, the dogs yapped. They were hungry. It was their feeding time. No one called him to feed them, though he would have if asked. He read Oliver Twist until the station wagon from HH came for him. The law was driving. His eyes were red with fury. His mouth was nothing but a stitch between his chin and his nose. The Bowies stood together in the long shadows of a January dusk and watched them drive off. When they got to Hetton House, Blaze felt an awful sense of familiarity fall over him. It felt like a wet shirt. He had to bite his tongue to keep from crying out. 3 months and nothing had changed. HH was the same pile of red and everlasting shit brick. The same windows threw the same yellow light onto the ground outside. Only now the ground was covered with snow. In the spring the snow would be gone, but the light would be the same. In his office, the law produced the paddle. Blaze could have taken it away from him, but he was tired of fighting. And he guessed there was always someone bigger, with a bigger paddle. After the law had finished exercising his arm, Blaze was sent to the common bedroom in Fuller Hall. John Chelsman was standing by the door. One of his eyes was a slit of swelling purple flesh. "Yo, Blaze," he said. "Yo, Johnny, where's your specs?" "Busted," he said. Then cried. "Blaze, they broke my glasses. Now I can't read anything." Blaze thought about this. He was sad to be here, but it meant a lot to find Johnny waiting. "We'll fix him." An idea struck him. "Or we'll get shovel chores in town after the next storm and save for new ones."
"Could we do that, do you think?"
"Sure. You got a C to help me with my homework, don't you?"
"Sure, Blaze, sure."
They went inside together. Chapter 10 Apex Center was a wide place in the road, boasting a barbershop, a VFW hall, a hardware store, the Apex Pentecostal Church of the Holy Spirit, a beer store, and a yellow blinker light. It was walking distance from the shack, and Blaze went down there in the morning after he held up Tim and Janet's quick pick for the second time. His goal was Apex Hardware, a scurgy little independent, where he bought an aluminum extension ladder for $30 plus tax. It had a red tag on it saying, "Priced to sell." He carried it back up the road, tromping stolidly along the plowed shoulder. He looked neither right nor left. It did not occur to him that his purchase might be remembered. George would have thought of it, but George was still away. The ladder was too long for the trunk or the back seat of the stolen Ford, but it fit when he placed it with one end behind the driver's seat and the other jutting into the front passenger seat. Once that was taken care of, he went into the house and turned the radio on to WJAB, which played until the sun went down. "George?" No answer. He made coffee, drank a cup, and lay down. He fell asleep with the radio on, playing Phantom 409. When he woke up, it was dark, and the radio was just playing static. It was 7:15. Blaze got up and fixed him some dinner, a bologna sandwich and a can of Dole pineapple chunks. He loved Dole pineapple chunks. He could eat them 3 times a day and never get his fill. He swallowed the syrup in 3 long gulps, then looked around. "George?" No answer. He prowled restlessly. He missed the TV. The radio wasn't company at night. If George was here, they could play cribbage. George always beat him because Blaze missed some of the runs and most of the 15-2s. They were arithmetic. But it was fun charging up and down the board, like being in a horse race. And if George didn't want to do that, They could always shuffle four decks of cards together and play war. George would play war half the night, drinking beer and talking about the Republicans and how they fuck the poor.
Why? I'll tell you why. For the same reason a dog licks his balls. Because they can.
But now there was nothing to do. George had showed him a solitaire game, but Blaze couldn't remember how it went. It was way too early to do the kidnapping. He hadn't thought to steal any comic books or skin mags when he was in that store. He finally settled down with an old issue of X-Men. George called the X-Men the Homo Corps, as if they'd come from an apple. Blaze didn't know why. He dozed off again at 7:45. When he woke up at 11, he felt muzzy-headed and only halfway in the world. He could go now if he wanted. By the time he got to Ocoma Heights, it would be past midnight. But all at once he didn't know if he wanted to. All at once it seemed very frightening, very complicated. He had to think it over, make plans. Maybe he could think of a way to get into the house on his own, look it over, make like he was from the public waterworks or the electric company, draw out a map. The empty cradle standing by the stove mocked him. He fell asleep again and had an uneasy dream of running. He was chasing someone through deserted waterfront streets while seagulls whirled over the piers and warehouses in crying flocks. He didn't know if he was chasing George or John Cheltzman. And when he began to catch up a little, and the figure looked back over one shoulder to grin mockingly at him, he saw it was neither one. It was Margie Thurlow. When he woke, he was still sitting in the chair, still dressed. But the night was over. WJAB was on again. Henson Cargill was singing Skip a Rope. He got ready to go again the second night, but he didn't go. The day after that, he went out and shoveled a long and senseless track toward the woods. He shoveled until he was winded and his mouth tasted like blood. I'm going tonight, he thought. But the only place he went that night was to the local beer store to see if the new comic books had come in. They had, and Blaze bought three. He fell asleep over the first one after supper, and when he woke, it was midnight. He was getting up to go in the bathroom and take a leak, then he'd hit the rack, when George spoke.
George?
Are you gutless, Blaze?
No, I ain't.
You've been hanging around this place like a dog with its balls caught in a henhouse door.
No, I ain't. I did lots of stuff. I got a good ladder.
Yeah, and some comic books. You been having a good time sitting around here, listening to that shit-kicking music and reading about superpower faggots, Blazer?
Blaze muttered something.
What did you say?
Nothing.
I guess not, if you don't have the guts to say it out loud.
All right. I said no one asked you to come back.
Why, you ungrateful, low-life son of a bitch.
Listen, George,
I took care of you, Blaze. I admit it wasn't charity. You were good when you were used right. But it was me who knew how to do that. Did you forget? We didn't always have three squares a day, but we always had at least one. I saw that you changed your clothes and kept clean. Who told you to brush your fucking teeth?
You did, George.
Which you are now neglecting, by the way. And you're getting that dead mouse mouth again.
Blaze smiled. He couldn't help it. George had a cute way of saying things.
When you needed a whore, I got you one of those, too.
Yeah, and one of them gave me the clap.
For 6 weeks, peeing fit to kill him.
Took you to the doctor, didn't I?
You did, Blaze admitted.
You owe me this, Blaze.
You didn't want me to do it.
Yeah, well, I changed my mind. It was my plan and you owe me.
Blaze considered this. As always, it took him a long and painful time. Then he burst out.
How can you owe a dead man? If people walked by, they'd hear me talking to myself and answering myself back and think I was crazy. I probably am crazy.
Another idea occurred to him.
You can't do nothing with your cut. You're dead.
And you're alive, sitting here, listening to the radio playing those numb-fuck cowboy songs, reading comic books and beating your meat?
Blaze blushed and looked at the floor.
Forget and rob that same store every third or fourth week till they stake the place out and catch your ass? Sit here looking at that numb-fuck crib and sweet mother cradle in the sweet fucking meanwhile?
I'm gonna chop the cradle up for kindling.
Look at you, George said, and what was in his voice sounded beyond sadness. It sounded like grief. Same pants on every day for 2 weeks. Piss stains in your underwear. You need a shave, and you need a fucking haircut in a worse way. Sitting here in this shack in the middle of the mumblefuck woods. This ain't the way we roll, don't you see that?
You went away, Blaze said.
Because you were acting stupid. But this is stupider. You have to take your chance or you're gonna fall. You'll do 5 years here, 6 there. Then they'll get you on 3 strikes and you'll sit in the shank for the rest of your life. Just a 2-bit dummy who didn't know enough to brush his teeth or change his own socks. Just another crumb on the floor.
Then tell me what to do, George.
Go ahead with the plot. That's what you do.
But if I get caught, it's the long bomb. Life.
It had been preying on his mind more than he wanted to admit.
That's gonna happen to you anyway, the way you're going. Ain't you been listening to me? And hey, you'll be doing him a favor. Even if he don't remember it, which he won't, he'll have something he can blow off his bazoo about to his country club friends for the rest of his life. And the people you'll be ripping off, they stole the money themselves. Only like Woody Guthrie says, with a fountain pen instead of a gun.
What if I get caught?
You won't. If you run into trouble with the money, if it's marked, you go on down to Boston and find Billy O'Shea. But the main thing is, you just gotta wake up.
When should I do it, George? When?
When you wake up. When you wake up. Wake up! Wake up!
Blaze woke up. He was in the chair. All the comic books were on the floor and his shoes were on. Oh, George. He got up and looked at the cheap clock on top of the refrigerator. It was 1:15. There was a soap-spotted mirror on one wall, and he bent down so he could see himself. His face looked haunted. He put on his coat and hat and a pair of mittens and went out to the shed. The ladder was still in the car, but the car hadn't been running for 3 days, and it cranked a long time before it started. He got in behind the wheel.
Here I go, George. I'm gonna roll.
There was no answer. Blaze twisted his cap to the good luck side and backed out of the shed. He made a 3-point turn and then drove down to the road. He was on his way. Chapter 11. There was no problem parking in Ocoma Heights, even though it was well patrolled by the fuzz. George had worked out this part of the plan months before he died. This part had been the seed. There was a big condo tower opposite the Girard Estate and about 1/4 mile up the road. Oakwood was 9 stories high, its apartments inhabited by the working well-to-do, the very well-to-do, whose business interests lay in Portland, Portsmouth, and Boston. There was a gated visitor's parking lot on one side. When Blaze pulled up to the gate, a man stepped out of the little booth, zipping up a parka.
"Who are you calling on, sir?"
"Mr. Joseph Carlton," Blaze said.
"Yes, sir," the attendant said.
He seemed unruffled by the fact that it was now nearly 2 in the morning.
"Will you need a buzz-up?"
Blaze shook his head and showed the parking attendant a red plastic card. It had been George's. If the attendant said he would have to call upstairs, if he even looked suspicious, Blaze would know the card was no longer any good, that they had changed colors or something, and he would haul ass out of there. The attendant, however, only nodded and went back into his booth. A moment later, the gate arm swung up, and Blaze drove into the lot. There was no Joseph Carlton. At least Blaze didn't think there was.
George said the apartment on the 8th floor was a playpen leased by some guys from Boston, guys he called Irish Smarties. Sometimes the Irish Smarties had meetings there. Sometimes they met girls who did variations, according to George. Mostly they played cutthroat poker. George had been to half a dozen of those games. He got in because he had grown up with one of the Smarties, a prematurely gray mobster called Billy O'Shea, with frog eyes and bluish lips. Billy O'Shea called George Raspy because of his voice, or sometimes just Rasp. Sometimes George and Billy O'Shea talked about the nuns and the fathers. Blaze had been to two of these high-stake games with George and could barely believe the amount of money on the table. At one, George had won $5,000. At another, he had lost two. It was Oakwood, being near to the Girard estate, that had gotten George thinking seriously about the Girard money and the small Girard heir. The visitor's parking lot was black and deserted. Plowed snow glittered under the single-arc sodium light. The snow was heaped high against the cyclone fence that divided the parking lot from the 4 acres of deserted parkland on the other side. Blaze got out of the Ford, went around to the back door, and pulled out his ladder. He was in action, and that was better. When he was moving, his doubts were forgotten. He threw the ladder over the cyclone fence. It landed silently in a snowy dream puff. He scrambled after, caught his pants on a jutting wire strand, and went tumbling headfirst into snow that was 3 feet deep. It was stunning, exhilarating. He thrashed for a moment and made an inadvertent snow angel getting up. He hooked an arm into his ladder and began to trudge toward the main road. He wanted to come out opposite the Girard place, and he was concentrating on that. He wasn't thinking about the tracks he was leaving, the distinctive waffle tread of his army boots. George might have thought of that, but George wasn't there. He paused at the road and looked both ways. Nothing was coming. On the other side, a snow-hooded hedge stood between him and the darkened house. He ran across the road, hunched over as if that would hide him, and heaved the ladder over the hedge. He was about to wade through himself, just bullying a path, when some light, the nearest street lamp or perhaps only star glow, traced a silvery gleam running through the denuded branches. He peered closer and felt his heart bump. It was a wire strung on slim metal stakes. 3/4 of the way up each stake, the wire ran through a porcelain conductor. An electrified wire, then, just like in the Bowie's cow pasture. It would probably buzz anyone who came in contact with it hard enough to make them pee in their pants and set off an alarm at the same time. The chauffeur or the butler or whoever would call the cops, and that would be that. Over. Done with. Gone. "George?" he whispered. "Somewhere up the road?" A voice whispered, "Jump the fucker." He backed off, still nothing coming on the road in either direction, and ran at the hedge. A second before he got there, his legs bunched and thrust him upward in an awkward, rolling broad jump. He scraped through the top of the hedge and landed sprawling in the snow beside his ladder. His leg, lightly scratched coming over the Oakwood cyclone fence, left droplets of type AB negative blood on both the snow and several branches of the hedge. Blaze picked himself up and took stock. The house was 100 yards away. Behind it was a smaller building, maybe a garage or a guest house, maybe even servants' quarters. In between was a wide snowfield. He would be easily observed there if anyone was awake. Blaze shrugged. If they were, they were. There was nothing he could do about it. He grabbed the ladder and trotted toward the protecting shadows of the house. When he got there, he crouched down, getting his breath back, and looking for any signs of alarm. He saw none. The house slumbered. There were dozens of windows upstairs. Which one? If he and George had figured this out, if he had known, he had forgotten. Blaze laid his hand against the brick as if expecting it to breathe.
He peered into the nearest window and saw a large, gleaming kitchen. It looked like the control room of the Starship Enterprise. A nightlight over the stove cast a soft glow across formica and tile. Blaze wiped his palm across his mouth. Indecision was trying to crowd in, and he went back to get the ladder to forestall it. Any action, even the most trivial. He was trembling. "This is life!" a voice inside him screamed. "For this they give you the long bomb. There's still time. You can still..."
"Blaze!"
He almost cried out.
"Any window. If you don't remember, you'll have to creep the joint."
"I can't, George. I'll knock something over. They'll hear and come and shoot me, or..."
"Blaze, you got to. It's the only thing."
"I'm scared, George. I want to go home." No answer. But in a way, that was the answer. Breathing in harsh, muffled grunts that sent out clouds of vapor, he unhooked the latches that held the ladder's extension and pulled it to its greatest length. His fingers, clumsy in the mittens, had to fumble twice to secure the latches again. He had threshed about a great deal in the snow now, and he was white from head to toe. A snowman. A yeti. There was even a little snowdrift on the bill of his cap, still twisted to the good luck side. Yet except for the clink-clunk of the latches and the soft plosives of his breathing, it was quiet. The snow muffled everything. The ladder was aluminum and light. He raised it easily. The top rung reached to just below the window over the kitchen. He would be able to reach the catch on that window from two or three rungs farther down. He began to climb, shaking off snow as he went. The ladder settled once, making him freeze and hold his breath. But then it was solid. He started up again. He watched the bricks go down in front of him, then the windowsill. Then he was looking in a bedroom window. There was a double bed. Two people slept in it. Their faces were nothing but white circles. Just blurs, really. Blaze stared in at them, amazed. His fear was forgotten. For no reason he could understand, he wasn't feeling sexy, or at least he didn't think he was, he started getting a hard-on. He had no doubt that he was looking at Joseph Girard III and his wife. He was staring at them, but they didn't know it. He was looking right into their world. He could see their bureaus, their nightstands, their big double bed. He could see a big full-length mirror with himself in it, looking in from out here where it was cold. He was looking in at them, and they didn't know it. His body shook with excitement. He tore his eyes away and looked at the window's inside catch. It was a simple little slip lock, easy enough to open with the right tool. What George would have called a gimme. Of course, Blaze didn't have the right tool, but he wouldn't need one. The lock wasn't engaged. "They're fat," Blaze thought. "They're fat, stupid Republicans. I may be dumb, but they're stupid." Blaze placed his feet as far apart on the ladder as they would go to increase his leverage, then began to apply pressure to the window, increasing it gradually. The man in the bed shifted from one side to the other in his sleep, and Blaze paused until Girard had settled back into the rut of his dreams. Then he put the pressure back on. He was beginning to think that maybe the window had been sealed shut somehow, that that was why the lock wasn't engaged, when it came open the tiniest crack. The wood groaned softly. Blaze let up immediately. He considered. It would have to be fast. Open the window, climb through, close the window again. Otherwise the inrush of cold January air would wake them for sure. But if the sliding window really squalled against the frame, that would wake them up too.
"Go on," George said from the base of the ladder. "Take your best shot."
Blaze wriggled his fingers into the crack between the bottom of the window and the jamb, then lifted. The window rose without a sound. He swung a leg inside, followed it with his body, turned and closed the window. It did groan coming back down, and thumped into place. He froze in a crouch, afraid to turn and look at the bed, ears attuned to catch the slightest sound. nothing. But oh yes, there was. Yes, there were plenty. Breathing, for instance. Two people breathing nearly together, as if they were riding a bicycle built for two. Tiny mattress creaks, the tick of a clock, the low whoosh of air that would be the furnace, and the house itself, exhaling, running down as it had been for 50 or 75 years, hell, maybe 100, settling on its bones of brick and wood. Blaze turned around and looked at them. The woman was uncovered to the waist. The top of her nightgown had pulled to the side, and one breast was exposed. Blaze looked at it, fascinated by the rise and fall, by the way the nipple had peaked in the brief draft.
"Move, Blaze! Christ!"
He high-stepped across the room like a caricature lover who has hidden under the bed, his breath held and his chest puffed out like a cartoon colonel's. Gold gleamed. There was a small triptych on one of the bureaus, three photos bound in gold and shaped like a pyramid. On the bottom were Joe Girard III and his olive-skinned Narmenian wife. Above them was the fourth, a hairless infant with a baby blanket pulled to his chin. His dark eyes were popped open to look at the world he had so lately entered. Blaze reached the door, turned the knob, and paused to look back. She had flung one arm across her bared breast, hiding it. Her husband was sleeping on his back with his mouth open, and for a moment before he snorted thickly and wrinkled his nose, he looked dead. This made Blaze think of Randy, and how Randy had lain on the frozen ground with the fleas and ticks leaving his body. Beyond the bed there was a splotched sugaring of snow on the inside window ledge and on the floor. Both were already melting. Blaze eased the door open, ready to halt at the first hint of a squeak. But there was no squeak. He slipped through to the other side as soon as the gap was wide enough. Outside was a kind of combination hallway and gallery. There was a thick, lovely carpet under his feet. He closed the bedroom door behind him, approached the darker darkness of the railing that went around the gallery, and looked down. He saw a staircase that rose in two graceful twists from a wide entrance hall that went out of sight. The polished floor threw up scant glimmering light. Across the way was a statue of a young woman. Facing her, on this side of the balcony, was a statue of a young man.
"Never mind the statues, Blaze. Find the kid. That lad is standing right out there."
One of the two staircases went down to the first floor on his right, so Blaze turned left and padded up the hall. Out here there was no sound but the faint whisper of his feet on the rug. He couldn't even hear the furnace. It was eerie. He eased the next door open and looked into a room with a desk in the middle and books on the walls, shelves and shelves of books. There was a typewriter on the desk, and a pile of papers held down by a chunk of black, glassy-looking rock. There was a portrait on the wall. Blaze could make out a man with white hair and a frowning face that seemed to be saying, "You thief!" He closed the door and went on. The next door opened on an empty bedroom with a canopy bed. Its coverlet looked tight enough to bounce nickels on. He moved up the line, feeling trickles of sweat start on his body. He was hardly ever conscious of time passing, but now he was. How long had he been in this rich and sleeping house? 15 minutes? 20? The third room was occupied by another sleeping man and woman. She was moaning in her sleep, and Blaze closed that door quickly. He went around the corner. What if he had to go upstairs to the third floor? The idea filled him with the kind of terror he felt in his infrequent nightmares. These were usually of Hetton House or the Bowies. What would he say if the lights went on right now and he was caught? What could he say? That he came in to steal the silverware? There was no silverware on the second floor. Even a dummy knew that. There was one door on the short side of the hallway. He opened it and looked into the baby's room. He stared for a long moment, hardly believing that he had gotten so far. It wasn't a pipe dream. He could do it. The thought made him want to run. The crib was almost exactly like the one he had bought himself. There were Walt Disney characters on the walls. There was a changing table, a rack crowded with creams and ointments, and a little baby dresser painted some bright color, maybe red, maybe blue. Blaze couldn't tell in the dark. There was a baby in the crib. It was his last chance to run, and he knew it. As of now, he might still be able to melt away as unknown as he had come. They would never guess what had almost happened. But he would know. Perhaps he would go in and lay one of his big hands on the baby's small forehead, then leave. Then he had a sudden picture of himself 20 years from now, seeing Joseph Girard IV's name on the society page of the paper, what George called news of rich bitches and whinnying horses. There would be a picture of a young man in a dinner jacket standing next to a young girl in a white dress. The young girl would be holding a bouquet of flowers. The story would tell where they had been married and where they were going on their honeymoon. He would look at that picture, and he would think, oh, buddy, you never had no idea. But when he went in, he knew it was for keeps. This is how we roll, George, he thought. The baby was sleeping on its stomach, head turned to the side. One small hand was tucked under his cheek. His breathing moved the blankets over him, up and down in small cycles. His skull was covered with a fuzz of hair, no more than that. A red teething ring lay beside him on the pillow. Blaze reached for him, then pulled back. What if he cried? At the same instant, he spotted something that brought his heart into his mouth. It was a small intercom set. The other end would be in the mother's room or the babysitter's room. If the baby cried... Gently, gently, Blaze reached out and pushed the power button. The red light over it died out. As it did, he wondered if there was a buzzer or something that went off when the power went off, as a warning. Attention, mother! Attention, babysitter! The intercom is on the blink because a big, stupid kidnapper just turned it off. There is a stupid kidnapper in the house. Come and see. Bring a gun. Go on, Blaze. Take your best shot. Blaze took a deep breath and let it out. Then he untucked the blankets and scooped them around the baby as he picked him up. He cradled him gently in his arms. The baby whined and stretched. His eyes flickered. He made a kitteny nee-up sound. Then his eyes closed again, and his body relaxed. Blaze exhaled. He turned, went back to the door and went back into the hall, realizing he was doing more than just leaving the kid's room, the nursery. He was crossing a line. He could no longer claim to be a simple burglar. His crime was in his arms. Going down the ladder with a sleeping infant was impossible, and Blaze did not even consider it. He went to the stairs. The hallway was carpeted, but the stairs weren't. His first footfall on the first polished wood riser was loud, obvious, and unmuffled. He paused, listening, drawn straight to attention and his anxiety. But the house slept on. Now, though, his nerves began to unravel. The baby seemed to gain weight in his arms. Panic nibbled at his will. He could almost glimpse movement in the corners of his eyes, first one side, then the other. At each step, he expected the baby to stir and cry. And once it started, its wails would wake the house. George, he muttered. Walk, George said from below him. Just like in the old joke, walk, don't run, toward the sound of my voice, Blazer. Blaze began to walk down the stairs. It was impossible to be soundless, but at least none of his steps was as loud as that horrible first one. The baby joggled. He couldn't hold him perfectly still no matter how he tried. So far the kid was still sleeping, but any minute, any second. He counted. 5 steps, 6, 7, 8er from Decatur. It was a very long staircase. Made, he supposed,
for colorful cunts to sweep up and down at big dances like in Gone with the Wind. 17, 18, 9. It was the last step, and his unprepared foot came down hard again. Clack! The baby's head jerked. It gave a single cry. The sound was very loud in the stillness. A light went on upstairs. Blaze's eyes widened. Adrenaline shot into his chest and belly, making him stiffen and squeeze the baby to him. He made himself loosen up, a little, and stepped into the shadow of the staircase. There he stood still, his face twisted in fear and horror. "Mike?" a sleepy voice called. Slippers shuffled to the railing just overhead. "Mikey, Mike, is that you? Is it you, you bad thing?" The voice was directly overhead, speaking in a stage whispery, others are sleeping tone. It was an old voice, querulous. "Go in the kitchen and see the nice saucer of milk Mama left out." A pause. "If you knock over a vase, Mama will spank." If the kid cried now. The voice over Blaze's head muttered something too full of phlegm for him to make out, and then the slippers shuffled away. There was a pause. It felt like 100 years long. And then a door clicked softly shut, closing away the light. Blaze stood still, trying to control his need to tremble. Trembling might wake the kid, probably would wake the kid. Which way was the kitchen? How was he going to take the ladder and the kid both? What about the electric wire? What? How? Where? He moved in order to stifle the questions, creeping up the hall, bent over the rapt child like a hag with a bindle. He saw double glass doors standing ajar. Waxed tiles glimmered beyond. Blaze pushed through and was in a dining room. It was a rich room. The mahogany table meant to hold 20-pound turkeys at Thanksgiving and steaming roasts on Sunday afternoons. China glowed behind the glass doors of a tall, fancy dresser. Blaze passed on like a wraith, not pausing. But even so, the sight of the great table and the chairs with their soldierly high backs awoke a smoldering resentment in his breast. Once he had scrubbed kitchen floors on his knees, and George said there were lots more just like him, not just in Africa either. George said people like the Gerards pretended people like him weren't there. Well, let them put a doll in that crib upstairs and pretend it was a real baby. Let them pretend that if they were so good at pretending. There was a swing door at the far end of the dining room. He went through it. Then he was in the kitchen, looking out the frost-jeweled window next to the stove. He could see the legs of his ladder. He looked around for a place to lay the baby while he opened the window. The counters were wide, but maybe not wide enough. And he didn't like the idea of putting a kid on the stove even if the stove was turned off. His eye lit on an old-fashioned market basket hanging from a hook on the pantry door. It looked roomy enough, and it had a handle. It had high sides, too. He took it down and put it on a small wheeled serving cart standing against one wall. He tucked the baby into it. The baby stirred only slightly. Now the window. Blaze lifted it and was confronted with a storm window beyond that. There had been no storm windows upstairs, but this one was screwed right into the frame. He began opening cupboards. In the one below the sink, he found a neat pile of dish wipers. He took one out. It had an American eagle on it. Blaze wrapped his mittened hand in it and punched out the storm window's lower pane. It shattered with relative quiet, leaving a large, jagged hole. Blaze began to poke out the pieces that pointed toward the center like big glass arrows. "Mike?" That same voice, calling softly. Blaze stiffened. That wasn't coming from upstairs. That was... "Mikey, what did you-ums knock over?" From down the hall and coming closer. "You'll wake the whole house, you bad boy." And closer. "I'm going to put you down cellar before you spoil it for yourself."
The door swung open, and a silhouette woman entered behind a battery-powered nightlight in the shape of a candle. Blaze got a blurred impression of an elderly woman walking slowly, trying to preserve the silence like juggled eggs. She was in rollers. Her head in silhouette looked like something out of a science fiction movie. Then she saw him.
Who?
That one word. Then the part of her brain that dealt with emergencies, old but not dead, decided talking wasn't the right thing in this situation. She drew in breath to scream. Blaze hit her. He hit her as hard as he had hit Randy, as hard as he had hit Glenn Hardy. He didn't think about it. He was startled into it. The old lady folded to the floor with her nightlight beneath her. There was a muffled tinkle as the bulb shattered. Her body lay twisted half in and half out of the swing door. There was a low and plaintive meow. Blaze grunted and looked up. Green eyes peered down at him from the top of the refrigerator. Blaze turned back to the window and batted out the rest of the glass shards. When they were gone, he stepped out through the hole he'd made in the lower half of the storm window and listened. Nothing. Yet. Shattered glass glittered on the snow like a felon's dream. Blaze pulled the ladder away from the building, freed the latches, lowered it. It gave out a terrifying ratcheting sound that made him feel like screaming. Once the latches were hooked again, he picked the ladder up and began to run. He came out of the house's shadow and was halfway across the lawn when he realized he had forgotten the baby. It was still on the serving cart. All sensation left the arm holding the ladder and it plopped into the snow. He turned and looked back. There was a light on upstairs. For a moment, Blaze was two people. One of them was just sprinting for the road, balls to the wall, George would have said, and the other was going back to the house. For a moment he couldn't make up his mind. Then he went back, moving fast, his boots kicking up little puffs of snow. He slid his mitten and cut the flesh of his palm on a shard of glass that was still sticking out the window frame. He barely felt it. Then he was inside again, grabbing the basket, swinging it dangerously, almost spilling the baby out. Upstairs, a toilet flushed like thunder. He lowered the basket to the snow and went after it without a backward glance at the inert form on the floor behind him. He picked the basket up and just booked. He stopped long enough to get the ladder under one arm. Then he ran to the hedge. There he stopped to look at the baby. The baby was still sleeping peacefully. Joe the Fourth was unaware he had been uprooted. Blaze looked back at the house. The upstairs light had gone out again. He sat the basket down on the snow and tossed the ladder over the hedge. A moment later, lights bloomed on the highway. What if it was a cop? Jesus, what if? He lay down in the shadow of the hedge, very aware of how clearly his footprints back and forth across the lawn must show. They were the only ones there. The headlights swelled, held bright for a moment, then faded without slowing down. Blaze got up, picked up his basket, it was his basket now, and walked to the hedge. By parting the top with his arm, he was able to lift the basket over and put it down on the far side. He just couldn't lower it all the way. He had to drop it the last couple of feet. It thudded softly into the snow. The baby found his thumb and began to suck it. Blaze could see his mouth pursing and relaxing in the glow of the nearest streetlight. Pursing and relaxing, almost like a fish mouth. The night's deep cold had not touched it yet. Nothing peeked out of its blankets, but its head and that one tiny hand. Blaze jumped the hedge, got his ladder, and picked up the basket again. He crossed the road in a hurried crouch. Then he moved across the field on his earlier diagonal path. At the cyclone fence surrounding the Oakwood parking lot, he put the ladder up again. It wasn't necessary to extend it this time, and carried his basket to the top. He straddled the fence with the basket balanced across his straining legs, aware that if his scissors locked slipped, his balls were going to get the surprise of their life. He jerked the ladder up in one smooth pull, gasping at the added strain on his legs. It teetered for a moment, overbalanced, then fell back down on the parking lot side. He wondered if anyone was watching him up here. But that was a stupid thing to wonder about. There was nothing he could do about it if someone was. He could feel the cut on his hand now. It throbbed. He straightened the ladder, then balanced the basket on the top rung, steadying it with one hand while he swung carefully onto the lower rung. The ladder shifted a little, and he paused. Then it held still. He went down the ladder with the basket. At the bottom, he crooked the ladder under one arm again and crossed to where the Ford was parked. He put the baby on the passenger seat, opened the back door, and worked the ladder inside. Then he got in behind the wheel. But he couldn't find the key. It wasn't in either of his pants pockets, not in his coat pockets either. He was afraid he had lost it falling down and would have to go back over the fence to look for it when he saw it poking out of the ignition. He had forgotten to take it along. He hoped George hadn't seen that part. If George hadn't, Blaze wouldn't tell him, never in a million years. He started the car and put the basket in the passenger footwell. Then he drove back to the little booth. The guard came out.
"Leaving early, sir?"
"Bad cards," Blaze said.
"It happens to the best of us. Good night, sir. Better luck next time."
"Thanks," Blaze said. He stopped at the road, looked both ways, then turned toward Apex. He carefully observed all the speed limits, but he never saw a police car. Just as he was pulling into his own driveway, Baby Joe woke up and started to cry.